Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Talking Markets podcast series right here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Today's conversation will have a tilt towards the policy environment in Washington, D.C., as we will cover topics spanning U.S. trade policy to the Fed, among some other timely topics. Joining me for the conversation today, glad to welcome back to our 1285 podcast studio here in New York, Phil Orlando, Chief Market Strategist and Global Head of Investment Directors at Federated Hermes. Phil has been with Federated since 2003 and has 45 years of investment experience. Phil, it's been a bit of time since you and I last spoke, but it's great to have you in person here at the table today. Thank you for dropping by and for spending a few moments with our listeners and our clients here at UBS.
Dan, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me back.
Absolutely. So as I alluded to, Phil, within the landscape of D.C., a lot going on, a lot we want to cover with our listeners. Perhaps just reflecting most recently on Election Day, can you provide some thoughts, reflections on the outcomes we witnessed and maybe speak to the implications of those outcomes to the 2026 midterms, which will be here before we know it?
So this was an off-year election. So a lot of investors sort of write it off as being relatively meaningless. We were focused on four elections, the two governor races in Virginia and New Jersey, the mayoral race here in New York, and California's Prop 50, which was going to suspend the anti-gerrymandering law until the next census take in 2030. Not surprisingly, based upon the polls, polls are actually correct this time. Democrats ran the table with big margins in all four of those races. And that, in my mind, as we look ahead to calendar 26 and the midterm elections, has potentially significant implications. You look at President Trump's polling on key issues overall, the economy, inflation, things of that nature, and his numbers have dropped by, 10 points or so over the first, 10 or 11 months of this year, from Inauguration Day this year to Election Day, a couple of weeks ago. And Trump would argue, well, I'm not really on the ballot. But the reality is that he was on the ballot, because in a lot of the exit polling, individuals said that they were motivated to vote for the Democratic position, in many cases, more as a vote against President Trump rather than a vote for whatever the Democrat was standing for. So as we roll ahead to next year, the midterm elections, this is where it gets really interesting. And this is a topic that we've been talking about literally all year. You've got a situation where the Republicans right now in the House of Representatives have the smallest majority at five seats in a century. Now, why is that important? Because if you go back and study the history of midterm elections in the post-war era, from, let's say the mid-1940s to the present, Truman and FDR to the present, the party out of power historically regains an average of 25 seats. There have only been two instances in the last, 80 years in which the party in power actually added seats to their congressional majority, and that was President Bill Clinton and President George W. Bush. Every other president lost ground. And so if anything close to historical averages holds here, the Republicans have a five-seat majority now, party out of power historically regains 25 seats. Simple math, Dan, tells me that the Republicans are unlikely to have legislative control of Washington next year. We've anticipated that, as have, I believe, the Trump administration. One of the biggest questions that I get is why this year President Trump and his administration has been working so fast, so feverishly. They say, Phil, it looks like Trump's been shot out of a cannon, his hair's on fire, guns blazing. Why doesn't he just slow down and take his time? And the answer is, he doesn't have any time to take. He is a second-term president. He's only the second president in the U.S. history, Grover Cleveland being the first, who took a gap term. And so he's termed out after this. And knowing that he was likely to lose legislative control of the House in the midterms, his window of legislative opportunity was Inauguration Day this year to Memorial Day next year. Washington at that point clears out because everyone goes home to start to run for election. So the president knew, or I believe should have known, that he had legitimately a 16-month window of opportunity to get his aggressive agenda done, and that's why he's been working so feverishly. And that's also why I think you're seeing this gerrymandering frenzy going on in Texas and California and all these other states. Everyone's trying to, you know, get their toe in the door and try to get a leg up on the other party and try to, you know, bend the curve of history here. But if everything sort of plays out the way we think, you know, what the Republicans are able to get done in between, say, now and Memorial Day will be it. And for the Republicans, I think they're hoping that it's enough to end up with a Bill Clinton result or a George W. Bush result come November of next year.
So fresh on the minds of many voters, that being the recent government shutdown, the longest in U.S. history, a lot of finger pointing, though. Phil, how would you assess the overall economic impact? And are we more or less likely to experience another government shutdown comes the 30th of January, 2026?
Yeah, those are really good questions. So I'll take the easy part of that first, which is what is the economic impact? And we were shut down for a record 43 days. Divide 7 into that, that's 6 weeks. And what the experts were telling us is that there was going to be, you know, roughly a 1/10 to 2/10 per week GDP impact. So let's use the high end of that to be conservative. That means that you were going to lose, you know, approximately 1.2, 1.3 percentage points of GDP in the fourth quarter. Now, the third quarter, the quarter that ended in September that hasn't been reported yet, was really strong. As a matter of fact, the Atlanta Fed just took their estimate up again today to 4.2% based upon how good the trade data was in the month of August. We were at 3.1%. Blue chip consensus at 2.7%. But bottom line is the third quarter was really strong. So as you go into the fourth quarter, we thought the fourth quarter was going to be pretty good as well. We were forecasting 2.8%. We thought we were going to have a pretty good Christmas based upon the strength of the consumer. But, as Larry Kudlow would say, we're going to have to take, you know, a percent and a half percentage point away from that because of the economic impact of the government shutdown. So our next macro policy meeting at Federated will be that a couple of days right after the Thanksgiving period. So if we are still good on 2.8%, that means all things being equal, we should probably cut that back to about 1.5% or so. Now, I've seen some estimates that are closer to zero. I took a peek at the blue chip numbers before I came in here just to have a measure of comparison. They're at 0.8. So the fourth quarter is not going to be as good as the third quarter for no reason other than the economic impact of the shutdown. All right, so that's an important point. But the deal that was reached between the eight Democrats and all but one Republican keeps the government funded until January 30th. And so you ask the question, well, could this happen again? Theoretically, it could, but you're that much closer to the midterm elections, and you wonder who's brave enough to pay the political price for shutting down the government for essentially no reason. I know the media would love to believe that the Democrats were, you know, standing on strong moral ground and it was the Republicans that paid the biggest price of that. I'm not so sure. I think the thought process from the Republican side was actually very strong right here. And Trump was elected a year ago on the idea of trying to bring some fiscal sanity to the debt and the deficit. And we're running a $38 trillion federal debt right now, and the debt-to-GDP ratio is up around 126%. The additional money that was allocated to the Affordable Care Act subsidies during the pandemic was massive, and no one's really talking about this, but the way the subsidies worked is that if you were in the bottom 90% of America, you were basically entitled to ACA subsidies, which means that instead of a program that was offering a helping hand to the lower echelons of American society, let's say individuals who are at or below the poverty line, or perhaps individuals that are simply in the bottom half, what the program had turned into as a result of the subsidies during the pandemic was that we had a massive redistribution of wealth such that corporate America in the top 10% were providing free health care for the bottom 90%. And as a result, we're sitting here with $38 trillion in debt. So we need a better program. And I think the Republicans were trying to make that point. Let's let the subsidies expire and continue to extend a helping hand to the bottom half of America. For the Democrats to say, let's keep the subsidies going, Senate Minority Leader Schumer had made a very clever offer. Let's just extend them for a year, and then we'll address them then. But Schumer knows as well as I do, and as well as we just discussed a moment ago, that the Democrats were going to regain control of the House a year from now. So those subsidies were never going to be addressed. They were just going to continue ad infinitum. And this $38 trillion in debt, according to the Congressional Budget Office, was going to be, you know, something like $57 trillion in debt, you know, 10 years from now. So at what point do we put a stake in the ground and say, okay, enough is enough. We need to reintroduce some fiscal sanity here. And I think that's what the shutdown was all about. I mean, everyone can talk about, you know, the moral high ground here, but I think ultimately it was trying to develop some sense of fiscal sanity around $38 trillion in debt.
Just sticking with the economy, absent of a lot of recent data spanning employment data in particular, it does remain the view of the chief investment office here at UBS that we will see a 25 basis point cut at the upcoming December meeting, though perhaps heading into that with not as much certainty since pre-shutdown. So what are your views over at Federated, Phil, in terms of what the Fed may do in December and even into 2026?
Fabulous question. And if we were looking at the likelihood of a December rate cut at the last FOMC meeting back on October 29th, the chances of that were up around 95%. Mm. And if you go back and look at the SEP, the Summary of Economic Projections that the Fed published in September, they assured us that they had two cuts coming, one in October, one in December. Well, you look at the WIRP page today, and that 95% probability is now down to 40%. And you ask yourself, well, what happened? Well, what happened is that Jay Powell went up to the podium to deliver his post-FOMC presser, you know, 2.5 weeks ago, and told the American people that the prospect of a rate cut in December was not a done deal, far from it, or foregone conclusion, I think, was his exact quote. And so then the likelihood of the cuts have decreased. And here we are today. Now, in our view, as we studied the economy, the Federal Reserve has a congressionally mandated dual mandate. They're looking at two things. What's going on with the labor market? What's going on with inflation? And I think we would conclude the labor market right now is struggling, that particularly the less skilled portion of the labor market. We're going to get, you know, some more data now over the next couple of days because the government shutdown is over and we're going to start to play catch up. Our bottom line, though, is that the labor market is struggling. On the inflation side, inflation had spiked to a 41-year high in the middle of calendar 22 and has come down to a 4-year low in the middle of calendar 25. Now, the inflation data has perked up a little bit over the last couple of months, but the Federal Reserve would argue, and we would concur, that was largely a function of a one-time adjustment related to what was going on with the trade and tariff policies. We expect to see inflation lower looking out over the next 12 to 18 months. So a long-winded preamble to your question, Dan, but we would absolutely expect to see another quarter point cut from the Federal Reserve on December 10th, and we expect to see that follow up with three more quarter point cuts over the first, say, three quarters of next year. Embedded in that forecast is the fact that Jay Powell's term as the Federal Reserve Chairman expires in May. We think we know who the finalists are to replace Jay Powell. All of them will bring a more dovish portfolio to that office. So we expect that the Federal Reserve will correctly have a more dovish bias towards interest rates, such that the Fed funds rate by this time next year, we think, is going to be down around 3%. We think core inflation is going to be below 3%, maybe something in the neighborhood of 2.5%. All will be right with the world. And certainly the prospect of lower interest rates, a still strong consumer, certainly at the high end of it. The economy, we think, is still cranking along. Corporate earnings are growing. Corporate CapEx is very strong. All of that, we think, is a recipe for a very nice market as we look out over the next year or two.
Now, in 2025, investors, the market has been very focused on the progression of U.S. trade policy. As we're speaking, the Supreme Court is considering the legality of President Trump's use of IEEPA to impose tariffs. IEEPA stands for the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. I'm curious, Phil, as to your expectations for how this might ultimately play out.
Well, we've got a very different view than the consensus. The consensus believes, based upon the way the I guess the attorneys were arguing the pro and con on the trade and tariff situation before the Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago, that the justices were going to rule against Trump. And I've seen odds of that happening, 70-80 to 20 or 30. We've got a very different view. We think the Supreme Court is going to rule in favor of the president. Now, there may be some guardrails established or whatever, but this court, the Roberts Court, in our view, has gone out of its way to try to support the ability of the president to implement his plan, assuming that the plan is legal, of course. We believe that the president is within his rights on certain aspects of trade and tariff policy. So we think that ultimately this will get through. So then that raises the follow-up question is, why do we think this trade and tariff policies were necessary? What represents the legality of this? And this comes back to the debt and deficit issue we discussed a couple of minutes ago. That we're sitting here with $38 trillion in debt. And I've got this mental picture of President Trump sitting in the Oval with Scott Bessent and Jared Lutnick and Kevin Hassett and that whole crew, and the president saying, "All right, we ran a record balance of trade deficit of $1.2 trillion this year, and that cost us 50 basis points of GDP growth. In the first quarter of this year, we were running at an annualized run rate of $1.5 trillion balance of trade deficit. It's going to cost us 65 basis points. Yet we're trying to generate sustainable trendline growth of 3% or more and pay down $38 trillion in debt. So if we can figure out a way to neutralize the trade deficit or turn it into a profit, won't that make our lives that much easier in terms of achieving our goal?" Well, the answer, in my view at least, is yes. And so the president institutes the trade and tariff policies that we know on Liberation Day. Now, the rollout wasn't particularly well-arted. That's an understatement. It was done poorly. But you can't argue with the results. And we just got another data point today, Dan, that we now have, let's see, April, May, June, July, August. We now have 5 months of data. And in the first quarter of this year, we're running at an annualized run rate of a $1.5 trillion balance of trade deficit that was going to cost us 65 basis points of GDP growth. In the last 5 months, that balance of trade deficit has shrunk to about $788 billion on an annualized run rate. It's going to cost us about 33 or 34 basis points, literally half. So you can argue that he implemented it poorly, that it's unfair to certain countries, that it may not be legal, and that's what some folks are arguing. But the reality is it's actually working. We're getting less drag from trade. And ultimately, I think that's what the president was trying to achieve, try to grow the economy stronger, try to repay the debt and the deficit more quickly.
So with that, Phil, we've covered a lot of topics between now and year end. Anything else taking place in D.C.? I'm sure there's a lot, but anything top of mind for you that our listeners should be mindful of?
Dan, I think you always do a terrific job in terms of orchestrating the Q&A here. You ask the key questions. The one thing that I guess from a market standpoint, is that we've had a 43% rally that's been virtually uninterrupted from the Liberation Day bottom up until the Federal Reserve's last policy decision day on October 29th. 43% rally without a correction is kind of a big deal. Now, we've had a little bit, we've had about a 5% pullback here in the last couple of weeks. And now even the conductor on my train this morning was asking me when this thing is going to end. So I've got, Phil, I've got 6 years from retirement. What do I do here? And I said, Chuck, just take a deep breath. Just stay the course. And I said, look, could we have a 10% correction back to the 200-day moving average? Absolutely. As we look out to next year, which is the midterm election year, historically the market performs poorly in the two middle quarters of a midterm election year. Could that happen here? Absolutely. Particularly if the Democrats do as well in the midterms as they should. Markets historically then have to recalibrate how is the new Congress going to work with the existing president. So there's some, you know, consolidation that goes on. But once we get through that, historically the stock market from its midterm election year trough through the subsequent peak over the next 2 years for the current president, stock market does really, really well. Now, our forecast at Federated, based upon our review of the economy, corporate earnings, the appropriate price earnings ratio on capitalizing that earnings stream, et cetera, you know, we think the S&P could be up around, you know, 8,600 as we look out to the next couple of years. So if the market does pull back by, let's say, 10% from recent peaks, and it bottoms out in the low 6,000, 6,100, 6,200, something like that, and we're looking at a potential move over the next couple of years up to 8,600, I think that's a pretty nice move. So bottom line is be patient, sit tight, but look for an opportunity. Perhaps the market does get sloppy and does get oversold here at some point over the next couple of quarters. That, in our view, would be an opportunity to add to positions because we think the longer-term picture for the U.S. economy and the U.S. financial markets is a very bright one.
Well, terrific guidance there, Phil. Very generous with your time and for sharing your insights with our listeners, our clients. Look forward to having you back sometime in 2026 as we get closer towards the midterms. Phil, thank you again for joining me here in person for the conversation today. Great seeing you.
Dan, it was my pleasure, and happy Thanksgiving to you and to all your listeners.
Likewise. Thank you, Phil. Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.